There are now 4 proposals to increase funding to K-12 education after State School Superintendent Diane Douglas released hers. But will any of them move the needle?
The fact is that the size of any of these plans doesn't move Arizona off the bottom.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Also today on the show, the new head of the Scottsdale Area Chamber of Commerce, how Arizona can expand its international economic reach.
Recreating the madhouse on McDowell.
And falling out of summer envy.
Instagramming beach selfies, posting backyard barbecue photos. We see their sun-kissed faces under their blue skies and their lack of sweat rings, and it hurts. Now it's our turn.
Plus, writings on a welcoming Phoenix diner and what's left of a piece of the Valley's transportation history.
That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. It'll stay sunny and warm for the rest of the day, but not sunny and hot. We have finally emerged from the 100-degree temperatures around the valley. We may reach a high of 98 today. It'll be sunny and 97 tomorrow. Currently, with relative humidity at 15%, we're at 95 degrees. In valley traffic, a couple of accidents to watch out for. 51 southbound at 32nd Street, and also the 60 eastbound at Dobson.
Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio is continuing to testify in the contempt of court proceedings against him today. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports from the federal courthouse that new details are emerging about the sheriff's dealings with a confidential informant.
When Arpaio last took the stand in April, he acknowledged he'd hired a former intelligence contractor as a confidential informant. But when asked if the informant was investigating the federal judge in the case, Arpaio denied the judge was the target. In court Friday, plaintiff's lawyers attempted to show that informant, Dennis Montgomery, was trying to link the judge in an anti-Arpaio conspiracy with the Department of Justice and the plaintiff's law firm, and that the sheriff did take a personal interest. On the stand, the plaintiff showed Arpaio had received documents related to that conspiracy theory and had taken his own notes with some facts about the judge and possible connections to the plaintiff's law firm. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona environmental regulators say the federal government's new standard on ozone will be a, quote, major challenge for the state to achieve. The Obama administration yesterday tightened limits on ozone. The federal EPA says the new standard will reduce exposure to dangerous ozone pollution and prevent thousands of asthma attacks, emergency room visits, and even premature deaths. But the State Department of Environmental Quality today said achieving the standard will be difficult for Arizona because of the state's unique geography, meteorological conditions, and mix of emission sources. ADEQ currently monitors ozone concentrations in 10 counties and says 9 of them report ozone levels in excess of EPA's new standard too frequently.
There are now 4 plans that have been proposed to get more money to K-12 education. Governor Ducey wants to tap more into the state land trust. GOP legislative leaders have a proposal. Democratic lawmakers earlier this week put forward their ideas. And yesterday, State School Superintendent Diane Douglas released her plan. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services covered the release of Douglas's plan. And Howie, what are the highlights?
Well, it starts off with something that she actually trotted out a couple of weeks ago, which is to use the rainy day fund and the cash carry forward to immediately put $400 million to schools for teachers, whether that's for salaries or smaller class size. She also has a related plan for getting teachers into certain rural underserved areas, perhaps repaying their college loans. But it's a virtual smorgasbord, if you will, of ideas, ranging from some of the stuff dealing with whether we're sending too many kids to college, whether students need a longer lunch break because we're serving healthier food and it takes longer to chew the food, and of course the obligatory effort to kill Common Core.
How does her plan, is at least as it relates to funding of K-12 education, compare to the other 3 plans that we've seen released recently?
Well, it's closest in many ways to what State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt wants. He contends you really can't dig that deep into the trust, into the corpus of the trust, without harming it.
Which is what Governor Ducey has been talking about.
Exactly. Now, the legislature has come up with sort of a modified Ducey plan. It uses $100 million that the state already has, taps the trust for a smaller amount, and then goes ahead and raids the First Things First fund. That would require voter approval, as would taking more money out of the trust. Meanwhile, the Democrats have their own plan, and in some ways, it's a little bit like what Diane wants, to the extent that they're saying there is the money there, but they have a little bit of a twist to that. They say that Arizona right now is letting corporations divert $51 million a year to tuitions for scholarships for private and parochial schools. That increases automatically by 20% a year. And they say, rather than put that money into private schools, let's put that money into public schools.
We've been hearing some buzz about the possibility of a special session. Republicans have been meeting in the legislature in small groups to sort of talk about what members might be willing to support. Do you have a sense of whether or not we might see a special session? And if so, which of these plans or some combination of them lawmakers might be voting on?
Well, the leadership would like a special session for a couple of reasons. A, to take it off the table before the budget negotiations start so it doesn't get wrapped up in that. And B, to perhaps have an election on the issues of trust land and, if you will, first things first, before next November, so they can show that something's actually happening as opposed to waiting around. The problem has been in the House, where there are many Republicans who are not prepared to go along with elements of what the legislature wants. Whether we actually have the session, as the old saying goes, you need 16 senators, 31 representatives, and the governor all agreeing on something. At this point, that doesn't exist.
Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thank you as always.
You're very welcome.
The plethora of plans leaves a lot of questions about whether the various parties can compromise and if the state can afford to gamble with the short term by planning for the long term. ASU Associate Professor David Garcia was the most recent Democratic nominee for state superintendent of public instruction. And David, how are you viewing these proposals?
The way that I think about them, or the way that I think maybe taxpayers should think about them, is sort of, you know, what are the implications? And I think that there are a few things I would consider. First off, as a taxpayer, are you going to make me vote for something again? Some of these proposals require taxpayers to go in and vote on something that they've already voted on once, in some cases more than once. Another thing to consider is how far along or how far are we kicking the can on many of these proposals? Mm. When are we going to be back talking about these issues again under each one of these proposals? Is it a year gap? Is it a two-year gap? Is it a five-year gap?
And David, given where the state has been compared to other states in terms of financial commitment, also in terms of how well students have done as far as testing is concerned, how worried are you that Arizona kids in many ways have been put behind the eight ball? And if we delay further, do you think that could get worse? Or if we get the right plan in a year or two, will the right plan sort of take us back on track? And we shouldn't concern ourselves necessarily as much with the short term.
I think we should pay close attention to the long term here. One of my concerns with every plan that's out there is not a single plan goes in and fundamentally overhauls school finance. You got to put something in perspective here, Steve. Our school finance system was put in place now almost 35 years ago. I think that even though these plans create new pots or move money around in existing pots, if we're really going to take a step forward as a state, I think we need to go in and look at the entire funding system and really bring it up to date. That's what states have done successfully, in my opinion, who have done this well, is they have brought their entire system up to date instead of putting together another Band-Aid.
David, you were on the campaign trail as the Democratic nominee for state school superintendent, and I know that good ideas have a lot of opponents, bad ideas have a lot of supporters. That just happens with all of us in every aspect of business that we deal with. Why is this an issue when it seems like people are on the same page, at least saying that, yes, Arizona's public schools are underfunded? Why is it so hard to get enough people at the table to agree to a plan?
Well, you got to remember, Steve, there are two sides to funding. There's funding and there's revenue. And I think what makes this very difficult is you've got to get people at the table to agree on both the funding, in other words, how are we going to distribute resources, but also at the table of how are we going to raise the underlying revenue in order to support public schools. And if folks are coming to the table, for example, saying that there will be no new taxes, that already puts everyone there in a certain position. It already creates some parameters around the potential decisions. And so I think this is difficult because we're not just looking at funding. If we're going to do this well, we've also got to consider the revenue side.
David Garcia is associate professor in the Fulton Teachers College at ASU. He's also the former Democratic nominee for superintendent of public instruction for Arizona. David, thank you for the time.
Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
The issue of where more money for education would come from is also on the mind of Rebecca Gao, executive director of Stand for Children Arizona. Rebecca, what do you make of Superintendent Douglas's proposal?
Well, I think first off, we need to be thinking about the revenues in the state. I mean, we've learned the hard way over the last several decades that relying on the general fund and the current revenue structures creates a lot of uncertainty. So simply saying, oh, we're going to take $400 million out of the general fund every year, just at the outset, is kind of a big question.
When you look at the plan put forward yesterday by Superintendent Douglas and you compare it to the other plans that are out there, where do you see this plan fitting in with all the other ones that deal with essentially the same kind of thing that are floating around?
Well, the idea of using the rainy day fund or the surplus and any projected surpluses and devoting them all to K-12 education, I mean, that's not a new idea. And they all, Diane Douglas's plan, the Democrat plan, and the legislative plan all have elements of, oh, well, let's just keep using the general fund. And we've seen that that doesn't work. The size of the pie in Arizona is not big enough. We need to be creative and smart about additional sources of revenue so we can increase the size of the pie. I think it's great to focus on K-12 education. I really appreciate that the dialogue right now is about prioritizing K-12 education. That's a really, really important step in our state. But we're all fighting over, or all those ideas are fighting over, a limited pie, and that pie itself needs to grow. Because you have a few other things that are funded out of the general fund, like higher education. So are we going to starve higher education for K-12? We've got the healthcare and CPS and public safety. These things all put pressure on the general fund. So I think it's short-sighted to continue to try to deal the deck at the size we have it. If we can grow the size of the deck, then it becomes easier to deal the cards.
As an observer of the political process, do you get the sense that any of the plans that have been put forward can realistically be implemented?
Yes.
Which one?
I think the governor's plan has the most viability at the moment.
That's the state tapping the state trust lands plan.
Yeah. I think that we have still more to do. There is a danger in any of these plans and the way that some folks in particular are talking about their own plans as if we do this and we're done. I think the governor has acknowledged that this isn't the only step in the process. I think the governor has acknowledged that there are bigger issues we need to address, but that you have to start somewhere. And this plan starts us somewhere in truly increasing the size of the pie and having a conversation about what are the resources in our state that are there to support our kids, and how do we use them more efficiently? How do we manage them better? And hopefully that leads to bigger conversations. I mean, the fact is that the size of any of these plans doesn't move Arizona off the bottom. We would need $1 billion a year instead of $300 million a year in order for Arizona to be around 40th with Colorado in state funding. And also, $1 billion is about what's been removed from the system over time. So if you think about that as sort of a benchmark where we would truly have restored what was lost and moves us off the bottom, which everybody wants to do, then we need to have the conversation beyond, all right, we have some plans that get us maybe a third of the way there, and how do we get the rest of the way there?
Rebecca Gao is executive director of Stand for Children Arizona. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you.
Still to come, Valley Riders take on a local culinary hotspot.
I guess we just wanted to see how closely we could focus it and how personal we could get.
Some literary comfort food is just ahead. It's the show.
Good afternoon. It is The Show. I'm Steve Goldstein with Mark Brody. The show is a KJZZ original production blending news from our community with national and international stories. Valley weather for the rest of the day. It'll be sunny. We're expecting to reach a high temperature of 98 degrees. It'll be clear tonight with lows in the lower to mid-70s. And get your weekend off to a good start tomorrow. Sunny skies with a high of 97. Currently, relative humidity is at 15%. It's sunny and 95 degrees. In Valley traffic, an accident I-17 northbound at Indian School blocks the shoulder. Other collisions, I-10 westbound at 35th Avenue, I-10 eastbound at 16th Street, and the 51 southbound at 32nd Street. It's 219.
KJZZ is supported by the Phoenix Symphony, presenting a tribute to the brave as Civil War, World War I, and II imagery are projected above the orchestra while performing Shostakovich and Copland live, October 2nd through 4th, phoenixsymphony.org.
With both Governor Doug Ducey and Phoenix Mayor Greg Stanton pushing to strengthen economic relations with Mexico, some in the state are saying similar efforts could and should apply to other parts of the world, including Canada and China. On Monday, the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations, or PCFR, is hosting its latest International State of the State. This year's focus is on steering Arizona's future in international waters, and it'll feature Governor Ducey. Brett Johnson is vice president of PCFR. And Brett, what are signs that Arizona is ready to extend its reach internationally?
The governor, upon coming into office, one of the first people that he met with was the consular general from Mexico to the state of Arizona. And that just shows the strong ties with Mexico and Arizona. This obviously includes the trade office that the state of Arizona and the city of Phoenix have opened in Mexico City to increase trade. I think that the number of visits that Governor Ducey has made down to Mexico, the relationships that he is making with their political leaders as well as their business leaders. You saw Carlos Slim come up here earlier this year. I think these are all highlights of a different course of action that Arizona is on, especially in regard to international relations.
If we don't focus on Mexico, was there the feeling that Arizona also really needs to reestablish and strengthen relationships with Canada or European countries or China, for example, which is enormous in the economic realm?
I think we can't forget that during the recession, the Canadians came down and definitely were helpful in propping up our real estate market, and we obviously encouraged that. So there's a very strong ties with Canada. There's a very strong tie with the European Union, and there's a very strong tie with China. And I think even if you go to the past administration with Governor Brewer making her visits to China, as well as local leaders leading Phoenix sister city, Scottsdale sister city, type cultural tours out there, that only benefits Arizona in the long run because people are going to have Arizona on their mind when they're thinking of where do I want to set up business in the United States or North America, because it really isn't just United States anymore. People are looking at it from a continent perspective.
But is there one thing Arizona could clearly be doing better in your mind when it comes to dealing with other countries?
Absolutely. And I think that is in regard to being ambassadors. All Arizonians are ambassadors when they're going abroad, whether to be a foreign country or even to the state next door, is talking up Arizona, talking up the environment, the business culture here, the opportunities that are here. This is a great place to do business. And one thing I think that Arizonians come collectively from the going to visit family all the way up to the governor going around the world is being good ambassadors for Arizona. And rather than concentrating on historical news, concentrating on what's happening today.
Brett Johnson is vice president of the Phoenix Committee on Foreign Relations. We've been talking about the 2015 International State of the State, previewing it a bit. It's coming up on Monday. It's a discussion with Governor Doug Ducey about steering Arizona's future in international waters. Brett, thank you for the time.
Thank you very much, Steve.
A Phoenix diner is the inspiration for the next edition of a literary journal that's been partnering with local organizations and places. Four Chambers Press tomorrow will officially release its Welcome issue, which draws on writers' thoughts about Welcome Diner and Welcome Chicken and Donuts. It's the second edition in a series. To talk about it, I'm joined by Julia Fournier, a contributor to the Welcome issue, and Kelsey Pinckney, the assistant director for Four Chambers Press.
The first one was with the Phoenix Art Museum in March. this past March, and now this one is with Welcome Hospitality. So we put a call out for authors to write things for, about, inspired by Welcome Diner, Welcome Chicken and Donuts, and just the sense of identity and place that they create in downtown Phoenix. And we are publishing 20 pieces from 20 authors, and they're all local.
What was it about that particular place that led you to think we need to do something with this?
Well, I mean, going back to the Phoenix Art Museum, that was rather a very big production. And that was something that we got a huge response to, something we realized, like, whoa, people really like coming together and creating a public art. And so I guess we just wanted to see how closely we could focus it and how personal we could get. And Welcome has always been, I mean, Welcome Diner sits in the middle of a neighborhood that I happen to live in. And it's just a really, really cool part of that neighborhood. We decided that we wanted to see if people wanted to write about it, because they wanted to write about the Phoenix Art Museum, and there was a huge response to that. And so the thing is, like, people in Phoenix, like, we all operate within the same space, and we all experience things born out of the same kind of places and art. And to be able to just talk about it through literature together is something that we apparently are really good at. And so we just chose Welcome.
Julia, what drew you to this particular place?
I live in the neighborhood just north of Garfield, and so it's just a short bike ride away over 10th Street Bridge. And the food's amazing. The people that work there are fun. And it's a great place to watch people.
How do you put that into words on a page? I mean, how do you take that and translate it into something that you can write?
So the pieces in this issue are not all directly related to Welcome Diner. Some of them, like Welcome, is maybe a very minor character, and some of them it's a major character. In mine, it's just kind of peripheral. Like, at the end of my piece, we're going to go to Welcome Diner.
Mm-hmm. So how did you, I guess, craft your story, knowing that you had to incorporate this diner in some capacity? How did you craft it so that it played some kind of part, but in your case, maybe not the major part?
So I don't write fiction. I write creative nonfiction. So when I first saw the call for this issue, I didn't have anything in my repertoire that involved Welcome except for going there, and I couldn't think of anything special. And I worked on a poem, and so then someone reminded me, I drove for Uber for a year, and he said, "Don't you have any pieces, any Uber pieces about Welcome?" And I said, "No." And then I thought I had this really great story that I had never put on paper, and so that's what happened.
In reading the submissions and having gone through as many as you did, mm-hmm. did they make you think about this place differently, this place that you feel like you know really well and really like? Did you think about it or see it differently after having read these?
Yeah, totally. I think I learned a lot about just the different kind of experiences people can have. I think there was a lot of really cool takes that people took. Some of them made Welcome come alive, like be an actual character, like the place, Welcome Diner specifically, because Welcome Diner actually has a lot of history, and some of them would like use that history, and like sometimes Welcome would become kind of this like dark menacing character, sometimes it would become like, you know, a safe haven. And I think I learned just a lot of just how Welcome can be so many different things, and how people see it.
Julia, in the process of writing your piece, even though the diner itself plays a minor role, or in reading some of the others, did you think about this place differently?
I love Welcome Diner, and I guess it's cool to see in print that other people have the same kind of appreciation. I don't know.
Maybe give you a better sense of sort of the community of people who feel as you do about this diner.
Yes.
Julia Fournier is a contributor to 4 Chambers Press's Welcome Home Edition. We also heard from 4 Chambers Assistant Director Kelsey Pinckney. There will be a live reading from the new edition tomorrow evening at Welcome Diner in Phoenix.
Russia is in day three of its air campaign in Syria amidst increasing criticism as Russian warplanes continue to target not the self-proclaimed Islamic State, but forces opposed to the government of Bashar al-Assad. After receiving only an hour's notice from Russia on Wednesday, U.S. officials say they were caught off guard by the airstrikes and they've condemned them.
Here's The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick speaking with BBC diplomatic correspondent Bridget Kendall on the divergent strategies of the U.S. and Russia.
How can we tease apart Russia's strategic aims here? They want to prop up Bashar al-Assad, of course, dealing a blow to the United States diplomatically and on the world stage. ISIS to some degree, and also Russian Muslim fighters who Putin has said he wants to go after.
Well, that's right. I think the difficulty is there is a quite coherent public narrative, which was laid out yesterday at the United Nations by Foreign Minister Lavrov. It's been laid out by President Putin on television to the Russian people. And it sounds quite rational that the Russians are worried about the hundreds, possibly thousands of recruits that the so-called IS jihadists have managed to get in that part of the world who've gone to Syria to fight. And Russia would rather preemptively take the fight to them and crush IS in Syria than have them come home and have another terrorist bombing campaign in Russia like it suffered 15 years ago from Chechen insurgents. So in a way, as far as his own country goes, President Putin's kind of shifted the argument from the fear of a threat of from Ukraine, from eastern Ukraine, from the government in Kiev. And at certain times, Russian television has even said backed by a hostile US that just wants to destroy Russia. He's now saying to the Russian people, no, there's a new enemy. It's international terrorism again. And that's why we've got to go and fight in Syria. And there clearly is a threat and they clearly are worried. But what the airstrikes by the Russians now in their third day have largely done have suggested that actually there's a completely different motivation. And maybe the worry among Western leaders is perhaps this terrorist threat is being used as a pretext. And the real aim is to save Assad militarily and hopefully prop him up diplomatically. One must remember that this summer he was sort of being pushed back towards the Mediterranean Sea by encroachment both by these IS jihadists, but also other anti-government opponents, and had lost a significant amount of territory. And now he has air cover from the Russians. He's got his own ground forces. There are rumors that maybe they could be bolstered by the Iranians. So this is a way to take territory back. So that is the worry, that this is Russia's real aim. It isn't actually so much about getting rid of the terrorists. It's more about bringing Assad back. And with that extra complication, if the world wants to see this conflict end, wants to move on to political talks, is the Russian president just trying to secure his man, Assad, back in the fray so he can say those talks have to take place with him on board, that Assad will not go. He has to be part of Syria's future.
And you've said yourself that President Putin is always on the lookout for ways to teach the Americans that they're not the only game in town, and maybe this is one of those times. But let's look at the Americans just for a second. How does this change our calculations? The U.S. has backed some factions in Syria. They've trained others. Apparently, some of those factions were bombed by the Russians. Nothing is going to make President Obama pour troops into Syria, it seems. So what next for the Americans?
Well, I mean, it's certainly in public, it looks as though the Americans are on the back foot. President Obama is seen by the Russian president as a U.S. leader that doesn't want to intervene in yet another war far away. He doesn't want to get broiled down. So therefore, the Russians can play in this arena and gamble that they won't meet American weapons on the field, that the Americans won't move in to support the more moderate opposition who they have been arming and training to give them, for example, anti-aircraft missiles so they can shoot back at the Russians. Otherwise, there we would have a proxy war between the United States and Russia. And I think Mr. Putin's gamble is he doesn't think that Washington wants that. So what is the United States to do? Well, so far what they've been doing is pressing the Russians politically. There was a statement which was issued, I think it came out via the Turkish Foreign Ministry this morning. It's signed up by the US, by the French, Germans, Brits, by Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, expressing concern at Russia's actions and saying it'll only fuel extremism. But the more blunt message will be being put to President Putin in Paris today, where, as it happens, he has flown to have talks with the French and German leaders and also the Ukrainian president about that other conflict, Ukraine. But it started off with an hour and a quarter meeting between him and the French president. By all accounts, it was pretty frosty. Their handshake looked quite terse. And a French official said that what President Hollande was saying was, these are the conditions that we'd be prepared to deal with you on Syria. You've got to only attack the so-called IS or Al-Qaeda affiliates, that's to say the out-and-out extremists, not other opposition groups in Syria. You've got to make sure that you don't hit civilians. That's a real worry in Europe. Otherwise, the flood of refugees will get even bigger.
Yes.
And in the end, President Assad has to go as part of a political transition. I cannot believe that. What would President Putin have said to that? Some of it he would have denied there's a problem. The Russians already denying they're hitting civilians. He would have pointed that today, on their third day, they have actually hit, apparently, some IS targets. So he'd have said, we're doing what you want. And as far as President Assad goes, I'm sure he would have insisted that if President Assad went, the situation in Syria will be even worse. That's a real sticking point. So that's where the United States and its allies are, still trying to push diplomatically to try and find a way that the Russian intervention in Syria can be turned to something positive rather than a new escalation and danger of two separate air coalitions on the same space, hitting different targets and also in danger of hitting each other.
Well, Vladimir Putin has made clear that at least one of his aims in Syria is to show the world that the United States and its allies are not the only games in town. The big question now is, how does the United States respond? Bridget Kendall, BBC diplomatic correspondent. Thank you.
My pleasure.
That's The Takeaways, Todd Zwillick. Coming up, heading back to the Phoenix Suns' original home.
It was packed and loud, and that's back in the days when the only music during a game was dun, 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 dun.
Trying to recreate the madhouse on McDowell. It's The Show.
Good afternoon. This is The Show on KJZZ. He's Steve. I'm Mark. In Valley traffic, watch out for an incident I-17 northbound at Thomas. Elsewhere, collisions I-10 westbound at 35th Avenue, I-10 eastbound at 16th Street, and the 202 westbound Santan Freeway at Alma School. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Look for a high of 99 degrees. It is below 100, although still fairly warm, still above average for today. 94 is average for today. Clear skies tonight, overnight lows in the low to mid 70s. A sunny weekend on the way with a high tomorrow of 97, 94 on Sunday. Right now in Phoenix, with relative humidity of 15%, it's 95 degrees. And by the way, have you heard about the KJZZ mobile app? You can podcast the show. It's totally free. Download it right now. It's 2:36.
KJZZ is supported by SMOCA, the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art, celebrating the opening of three new exhibitions inspired by light. Reception is open to the public on Friday, October 2nd, starting at 7 p.m. More at smoca.org.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. President Obama says he's going to move the need for stronger gun control laws back into the spotlight and step up pressure on Congress following the latest mass shooting in the U.S., the killing of 9 people at a community college in Oregon.
The main thing I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about this on a regular basis. And I will politicize it because our inaction is a political decision that we are making.
Obama speaking at a White House news conference. Oregon Governor Kate Brown says her state has worked hard to prevent mass shooting tragedies.
But they continue to happen here and across the nation. And it is going to keep happening until we decide we want them to stop.
Investigators in Oregon say the gunman in the shootings there was heavily armed. They've recovered 13 weapons, half at the community college, the rest at the apartment that he shared with his mother. He also had a flak jacket and extra magazines of ammunition. All of the weapons were legally purchased. The Justice Department says police in St. Louis County, Missouri, are falling short of best practices in several key areas. Rachel Lipman reports that review was requested in the wake of the fatal shooting last year of an unarmed 18-year-old black man.
The federal review found that county officers don't receive nearly enough training on community-oriented policing and that the department resorts to tactical responses even when de-escalation is possible. Ronald Davis is the director of the Office of Community-Oriented Policing Services. He says the federal government is also concerned about racial disparities in the county's traffic stops.
I am not in a position today to say that that equates to racial profiling, except for that we believe that a much more in-depth assessment should be done so that the department can answer that question.
The report does not come with any threat of legal action. The Department of Justice will release follow-ups at 6 and 12 months. For NPR News, I'm Rachel Lipman in St. Louis.
On Wall Street, the Dow was up 200 points today. This is NPR News from Washington.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Fighting malaria has been one of the big success stories of medicine in recent years, with the number of childhood deaths dropping by 65% in deaths of children under five since 2000.
It's been estimated the reduction has saved more than 6 million lives. It's clearly going well, but will we ever be able to eradicate the disease for good? The BBC's Rebecca Morrell has been finding out.
I've just come into the insectary at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. It's very warm in here, about 30 degrees. I'm looking at dozens and dozens of boxes covered in netting, and inside of them are thousands of mosquitoes flying around.
These are Anopheles gambiae, so this is the one that transmits malaria most importantly in Africa, so that's the most dangerous mosquito in the world.
Professor Brian Greenwood has been working on malaria for the last 50 years. He says recently there's been remarkable progress, but the disease still kills more than 500,000 children each year. He believes a vaccine could save lives.
If we had a malaria vaccine that you could give as one or two doses in early childhood and protected people for everybody, that would be the answer. But unfortunately, it's not as easy as that. And developing a vaccine to malaria has been very much more difficult.
Earlier this year, the first ever malaria vaccine called RTSS was approved for use. It's a huge advance, but it's not as effective as scientists had hoped. It cuts cases of severe malaria by about a third, but it doesn't work on very young babies, and several booster jabs are needed. The problem is the malaria parasite.
Today, we know the demons which cause malaria are protozoan parasites transmitted, in the case of men, by female Anopheline mosquitoes, while taking the blood meal which they need to mature their eggs.
Seen under the microscope in this 1950s ICI film, the malaria parasite looks deceptively simple.
Minute, sickle-shaped bodies with one or more dots of nuclear chromatin.
But now we know, with its 5,000 genes, this tiny organism is incredibly complex. It's what's made creating a vaccine so difficult. And the parasite's ability to mutate and evolve has also been rendering the drugs that treat malaria useless.
Back in the 50s, chloroquine was a wonder drug, and it was almost the perfect drug in many ways, until the parasites became resistant. And that resistance spread across the world, starting in the late 50s. And then later frontline drugs also encountered resistance.
Professor Dominic Kerfiatkowski is from the University of Oxford and the Sanger Centre.
For some reason, the resistance always seems to take off first in a region of Southeast Asia, around Cambodia. And that's been true for waves of resistance to all of the major frontline anti-malarial drugs.
Worryingly, the problem has sprung up in this area once again. This time, it's resistance to artemisinin, the main malaria treatment used today. The fear is that this resistance could spread from Asia into Africa, putting many lives at risk. But Professor Kerfiatkowski says this time, though, advances in genetics could help.
Parasites and mosquitoes are evolving in real time. One of the holy grails is to be able to monitor that process in real time, just like we monitor the weather. And we're hoping that by pulling together genetic data from around the world, we'll start to get a sort of weather report on the parasite population and see storms arising before they happen and be able to intervene.
That report was by the BBC's Rebecca Morrell.
The Scottsdale Area Chamber of Commerce has a new leader. Mark Heagle is the group's new president and CEO. He started on the job yesterday. So, Mark, what are your goals in your new job?
There's probably a number of different things that I'm going to try and accomplish, Mark. First of all, a strategic plan. I'm not only going to find that strategic plan, that old one, and I'm not going to dust it off, but I'm going to actually replace it and start new. In addition to that, I want to focus on transportation in Scottsdale and how do we make that happen and move it forward, as well as get Scottsdale to have a better seat at the regional level and at the state level. And then probably lastly is to work with my counterparts. We're part of a group called the East Valley Chamber of Commerce Alliance, includes Mesa, Chandler, Gilbert, a number of other chambers and to make sure that we're all moving forward in the same direction.
Do you think that in general Scottsdale doesn't have as big of a seat at the table regionally as it ought to?
Absolutely, because, you know, the number of businesses that we obviously have land in Scottsdale and then go to other places too, other chambers and other areas around the state. But what we haven't done or realized as much is a lot of the people that might have a company, whether it be in Chandler, you know, we end up with the CEO or the COO or the CFO there. So we think it's important that we have that statewide seat where we actually participate with all our counterparts.
Why do you think that hasn't happened before now?
Well, I think a lot of the different chambers historically, were fighting for different businesses to make sure they end up in their town so that that drives their economic development. I'd like to look at it from the standpoint of, okay, on Monday morning, I'm going to fight you and I want that business to end up in Scottsdale or the Scottsdale Air Park. But on Tuesday morning, I want to wake up and say congratulations, or they congratulate us, and then we work together to move forward.
You mentioned transportation in Scottsdale, and I'm curious if you're talking about public transit or improving the infrastructure of roads and highways and stuff like that?
Well, it's actually a combination of both. I think we've done an excellent job historically in terms of, you know, improving public transportation. But what are we going to do in 10 years or 20 years as we continue to grow?
Do you consider it a challenge to sort of bring together the different parts of Scottsdale? I mean, you have sort of the urban downtown core, Old Town, the downtown area, lots of apartments and high rises in that area. And then in the northern part of the city, it's much more deserty and open and almost kind of rural. I mean, do you consider those two different parts of the city?
No, I actually would like for us all to see it as part of the greater Scottsdale area. That's what makes a community vibrant. When people come to Scottsdale, I look at 8 different areas that you might call downtown. Whether you want the nightlife, whether you want the desert scene, whether you want Old Town Scottsdale, they're all part of what we have as a total Scottsdale. And that's the most important thing to me, and make sure that our growth, and I want to continue to grow, is responsible growth.
When you talk about growth, are you focused more on commercial growth, office growth, residential growth?
I think it's a combination of all three, but I think one of the top areas that I'd like to look at is, you know, we've got a whole group of millennials right now, and they want to be in an area that has maybe a storefront with 2 or 3 condos up above, and that's our future. So, you know, can we have different areas around the city that actually produce that, as well as still have our outlying areas that, you know, if you want that suburban feel, you know, that's fantastic. And we have areas that are like that right now. But what I haven't seen enough of that I'd like to see more of is some of those areas that millennials will come to and say, yeah, I want to live there. That's vibrant.
Mark Hegel is the new president and CEO of the Scottsdale Area Chamber of Commerce.
For the first quarter century of their NBA existence, the Phoenix Suns played their home games at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. As a younger person, I saw the Suns take on some of the top teams in the NBA there. And even though it's been a successful organization, my in-person memories are usually about the opponents, like when Larry Bird hit a buzzer beater to defeat the Suns, or when Dr. J, Julius Erving, came to Phoenix on his retirement tour. I'm pretty sure I still have the poster from that one. The Coliseum has become pretty outdated since the Suns left in 1992. And is now known better for state fair-related concerts. The Suns are going back to their original home for one afternoon anyway, as they host a special scrimmage on Saturday. I headed over there as well to see the temporary setup and talk to Suns legend Alvin Adams, who's also the longtime facilities manager at Talking Stick Arena, the Suns' current home, formerly known as U.S. Airways Center and America West Arena. I started by asking him how big an impact Suns fans had at the Coliseum.
To me, it was simply home. And home is a good place to be. And home can be loud or happy, and ours was loud and happy. And when we needed that boost, at the beginning of the season, my first season, I don't remember how loud the fans were or weren't, but boy, come the end of the season, we're making that playoff push, and every one of those playoff games, it was, I didn't think you could get any louder or any more people in here, and it was packed and loud. And that's back in the days when the only music during a game was dun, 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 dun. And today, because of perhaps the gorilla and all the other cool things that we do in game entertainment. We've got music and light shows and pyrotechnics and contests and get the fans involved. I don't remember the fans coming. Maybe they did halftime when we were in the locker room. Maybe they did some stuff and had the halftime act. But this was home. We were comfortable. I don't know what our winning percentage was. It was high. Most of the years I played, the 13 years I played, I think we made the playoffs 9 or 10 years, so we had great crowds. I'm looking here at the east end as we stand here and talk, as we stand at the west end of the court looking back at the east, and I go, that's the route to the locker room. The southeast corner was our bench. I'm seeing them set the scoring table right now. Your listeners can't see it, but the scoring table is actually just folding tables with legs. That's what we had when we played, and they Velcro up some signs that say CBS Sports or Sanders and Vort or whatever. And, of course, today we have these electronic LCD boards with electronic signs. So it's come a long ways. This is our floor. We brought our floor over, and we brought our goals over, but everything else is vintage.
Did you have a favorite spot on the floor? I remember as a kid watching you play. Now, there's not a huge age difference, but there's enough between us. I remember you sort of setting up between, let's say, the free throw line and what is now the three-point line. So somewhere like 19, 20 feet away, you do a little head fake, you might drive, you might shoot the jumper.
Exactly. Well, you have a very good memory from 30, 40 years ago. Remember, I'm only 6'9". I was a little guy because I'm guarding guys. I played center most of the first half of my career, almost the whole first half of my career, and I'm guarding guys that are what? 6'10 to 7'1.
You
mentioned Kareem. And so Coach McLeod came up with this innovative thing. I kind of became I was a high post center. You know, in high school and college, I was a big guy at 6'9". I played low post, but I'm not going to go down and play low post against the Kareems and Laniers and Thurmans and Gilmores of the world.
Let's talk about what it took to get this going. How long has this been in the works?
We had some good experience having those 3 years of games in Palm Springs at the tennis garden outdoors. So we took some of our equipment. We took some of our people over there. And tennis is about the same size as basketball. So that was great. Most of that seat was permanent. These multi-purpose arenas like where we're standing now at the Coliseum and our arena downtown, they have a lot of flexibility in the seat arrangements and the retractable seating. So it's very easy to bring a court over. We brought our court over. And we've been talking about this since the Palm Spring days. So we've been talking about this idea for 5 years or so. Like, wouldn't it be cool to get over here and do this?
I will not ask you to do this. Obviously, the baskets are not set up. But anytime before the scrimmage, are you going to maybe step out and shoot a couple times?
You know, all my friends have been telling about this. I go, hey, you need to come. They go, Will, are you going to play? And I go, no, I'm not going to play. I'm not going to put on my old short shorts, and I'm not going to play. I could make a free throw. I could dunk right now because the goals are in their stored position, which means the rim's only about 4 feet above. You could dunk, too. We could go out and have a dunk off.
Was that
right
a backhanded compliment? I don't know.
We could have a dunk off right now, but we'd probably hurt ourselves.
Phoenix Suns legend Alvin Adams reliving memories at the Veterans Memorial Coliseum. The Suns will hold a special scrimmage for free at the Coliseum, the team's original home, tomorrow evening at 6.
Good afternoon. You're listening to the show on KJZZ with Steve Goldstein. I'm Mark Brody. No dunking contests here. I would certainly lose if we tried to do that. Checking Valley traffic, I-10 westbound, a collision at 35th Avenue, I-10 eastbound, one at 16th Street, I-10 westbound at the 143, and on the Santan Freeway 202 westbound, a collision on the side of the road at Alma School. Sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon today. Look for a high of 99 degrees. We hit 106 yesterday. 94 is average for today. Clear skies on the way for tonight with overnight lows in the low to mid 70s. And a sunny weekend on the way for the Phoenix area with a high tomorrow of 97 down to 94 on Sunday. Very slight chance, by the way, of showers on Sunday. It's 95 degrees at KJZZ at 253.
Expanded local coverage of arts and culture, early childhood, and healthy aging is made possible by support from Virginia G. Piper Charitable Trust.
You may have noticed it while walking along. The piece of concrete really stands out. Look closely enough and you'll notice it was briefly an important piece of the Valley's transportation system. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us more about it.
Tempe Beach Park is filled with pathways, grass, a kid's play area, and an abutment. Yes, you heard right. It's the Ash Avenue Bridge abutment in the middle of the park. Did you know the Ash Avenue Bridge was among the first passages constructed in the area to cross Rio Salado?
From 1911 through 1913, the construction took about a year and a half, almost 2 years, and it was commissioned by the Territory of Arizona. And George W. P. Hunt was the governor of the territory.
Mark Vinson is an architect with the city of Tempe, and he takes me on a walk near the over 100-year-old structure.
It was constructed using convict labor. Convicts from the state prison at Florence were brought in to do the construction.
The Ash Avenue Bridge abutment, which is the southern end of the bridge, faces the lake. In the late 1800s and early 1900s, residents in the Tempe area crossed the river either by foot, horseback, wagon, or ferry, depending on the level of the Rio Salado, or Salt River. By around 1900, local leaders began discussions to build a bridge because construction of the Theodore Roosevelt Dam upstream would be underway. Phoenix built a bridge, and another was constructed in Tempe.
So Governor Hunt assured the townsfolk of Tempe that it would be a safe project and no convicts would escape, and that he would resign if any convicts escaped during construction of the project. My understanding is that one or two did, and he didn't resign, but it's because they caught him.
The bridge was completed in 1913. People as well as merchants used it.
In the intervening years between 1911 and 1913, that was kind of the introduction of the automobile to Arizona. And by the time the bridge was completed, it was in a way obsolete. It was only wide enough for the wagons and the tractors to go back and forth.
A 1920s flood weakened a few of the supports for the bridge, making it unsafe for vehicles. By 1931, a new bridge was constructed to replace it. Yes, you guessed it. Mill Avenue Bridge. The Ash Avenue Bridge remained standing for several decades. Only pedestrians and bikers were able to use it. By the 1990s, when construction began on the town lake, the bridge was determined unsafe. It had to come down. The city decided to keep the abutment as a reminder of its transportation history. Today, the Ash Avenue Bridge abutment has been restored. The area around it has been enhanced with a handicap access ramp to the abutment overlook, which has a perfect view of the beach park and lake. This area is the Visitor's Plaza, named the Veterans Memorial in Tempe Beach Park. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez.
If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique or just know something we should know, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
An essay titled "Fall is the Worst Season" on the site Jezebel has been making the rounds. It's a screed on the horrors of autumn and all it represents.
In part, it reads, "Fall is seasonal twilight, the kind where the air drops 20 degrees when the sun disappears behind the buildings and you look around, suddenly detached from your body, having lost track of your desires."
But for those of us in the valley, fall means something entirely different. It means the end of the hellacious summer and the start of something glorious. Lilia Menconi spends a lot of time outdoors. She's the author of a hiking guide called Moon Take a Hike Phoenix. Here are her thoughts on the changing of the seasons.
I'm out of shape. I'm irritated. I'm impatient, and I'm still sweating. But that's all okay, because we finally made it to October. Fall, the home stretch, the time of year when we as Phoenicians can finally start dreaming about the glorious winter. For most of the U.S., fall means the agonizing goodbye to sunshine, the outdoors, and fit bodies. It's the beginning of the end, the spiral into seasonal defeat and eventual depression. But not us. Nope, we've paid our annual dues. We've dealt with the constant disappointment of the seemingly never-ending triple-digit forecast. And we've been hurt by our friends and family, Instagramming beach selfies, posting backyard barbecue photos. We see their sun-kissed faces under their blue skies and their lack of sweat rings, and it hurts. Now it's our turn. We have a future to look forward to. to picnics and bicycle bar crawls and afternoon walks. And for me, the future is all about winter hiking. I'm not talking about hiking with the tourists up Camelback Mountain. I'm talking about the real stuff. 7, 8, 12 miles of cutting through canyons, hopping across washes, and tiptoeing through Cholla forests, without the oppressive sun or constant threat of heat stroke. Hikes where the only sound you hear for hours is the steady crunch of rock underfoot, where you take multiple pee breaks with just a few wimpy desert shrubs for cover, and where you get so engrossed in conversation with a friend that you can barely see the trail through the tears in your eyes. Hiking is my winter thing. That's what I dream about in fall. I'm sure you have your winter thing, the thing that makes muscling through the sweltering summer worth it. Drinking on the porch, a 10 a.m. jog, or just the luxury of opening up all the doors and windows to air out the house. Start dreaming, because the dream is about to become very, very real. Phoenix, welcome to fall.
Lilia Manconi is the author of the hiking guide Moon, Take a Hike Phoenix.
Fall is here, hear the yell, back to school, ring the bell.
It might be kind of cool enough to take a hike outside this weekend. If you'd like to do something else, you can check out comedian Dave Coulier, he of Cut It Out fame from Full House. He'll be at the Tempe Improv tonight and tomorrow.
And Bob Saget was in town recently
as
well. We've got a whole
run
of these folks. This weekend is the Arizona Diamondbacks' last series because they did not make the playoffs. They're playing the Houston Astros tonight at 6:40 and then various times on Saturday and Sunday.
And you can check out Rascal Flatts. They'll be performing tonight at Ak Chin Pavilion.
The show was produced by our senior producers, Sarah Ventry and Jimmy Jenkins, with help from Bruce Drummond, Anika Klein, Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, Regina Revozova, and Tiara Vian. Sky Shout, Domenico Nicosia, the digital team. Our managing editor is Tracy Greer, news director Al Macias, and the executive producer is John Hoban. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. This is member-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix in HD. We hope you have a splendiferous weekend. It's 3 o'clock.